I have to start again with this thing. So this is October the 7th, 1909, the reason for trials. As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, my jealousy and the caution I have for my creatures is such and so great that in order not to let them be ruined, I am forced to surround them with thorns. Now notice that we can ruin things by our reactions to them, okay? So thorns both in soul and in body. That means that you can have difficulties interiorly and exteriorly. So that the thorns may keep away from them the mud that can dirty them. In other words, the difficulties he allows you to have actually saves you from being pulled down by the world. This is why, my daughter, I surround with thorns, that is, with bitterness, privations, and different interior states, also my greatest favours, which I favour the souls who are dear to me, so that these thorns may not only preserve them, my book says keep them, preserve them, but prevent their getting dirty with the mud of the love of self and the like. Now, the love of self and spiritual pride destroys everything. Okay, he disappeared. So October the 14th, 1909. Proofs that it's Jesus who actually goes to Louisa. Continuing in my usual state, I seem to find myself with a baby in my arms. And from one they became three, and I felt all immersed in them. Now, in the morning when the confessor came, he asked me whether Jesus had come, and I told him what is written above. I love this. Without adding anything else, so the confessor told me, didn't they tell you anything? Didn't you understand anything? And Louisa said, I can't say it well. Watch the frustration of the priest. I love this. He said, the whole Trinity was here and you can say nothing. Fascinating, isn't it? You've become more stupid, he said. These are only dreams. So he's not accepting any reality there. And Louisa said, yeah, it's true. They're only dreams. He continued to say other things. And while the confessor was speaking, I felt clasped so very tightly by the arms of Jesus, to the point of losing consciousness. So she goes into ecstasy, okay? And Jesus told me, who is it that wants to molest my daughter? He's talking about the priest, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And Louisa said, Father is right, she defends the priest. Since I'm unable to say anything, they, that is the priests, have no sign that it is Jesus Christ that comes to me. And Jesus continued, I act with you as the sea would with a person who would go and dive into the depths of the sea. I plunge all of you into my being in such a way that all of your senses remain inundated, and in such a way that if you want to speak about my immensity, which she does do in the highest volumes, okay, if you want to speak about my immensity, my depth and my height, you can say only that it was so great that your sight was lost. If you want to speak of my delights and my qualities, which she will do in the highest volumes, you can say that they are such and so many that they went about opening your mouth to count them. You are drowned in them, and so with all the rest. Besides, what is this? I've given you no sign that it is me. False. Who has kept you in bed for 22 years without breaking you? And with full calm and patience, because that's a miracle in itself, isn't it? Has it perhaps been their power? The word virtue actually is used in terms of power, or my power? And what about the tests they made during the first years of this state of yours, or making you remain immobile for 10, 7, or even 18 days? That's in volume one, do you remember? Without taking any of the necessary nourishments. Were they perhaps the ones who maintained you, or was it me? So guess who's being ticked off now? Okay. Then, since the priest had called me, Louisa said, I returned into myself. And then, as the confessor celebrated Holy Mass, I received Holy Communion and Jesus came back. I lamented to him that he was not coming as before. Now, we are on volume 9, and she is in a process of being changed from being a victim soul into the person that will be the key to opening the kingdom of the divine will, which is a huge change in vocation. And she doesn't understand it. The priests don't understand it. None of them understand it except the Lord himself. So I lamented to Jesus that he was not coming as before, that the great love that he had for me seemed to have turned into coldness. It's true that as I lament to you, you always give excuses that you want to chastise. Now, here she's admitting that she knows that when he doesn't come, he's chastising. And yet, in that first message we had this evening from October the 4th, she said it was her own sins. And she knows because he's been saying it to her for 9 volumes now. You say that you want to chastise and this is the reason why you don't come, but I don't believe it. Now, actually underline that. That is her problem. She actually doesn't believe the Lord. And the Lord, can the Lord tell you a lie? He is truth itself. Who knows what evil there is in my soul? See the way she goes back to it. And because of it, you won't come. Tell me at least, for at any cost, even of giving my life, I will remove it. In other words, she would do anything to get him back. She's not really talking about the sins. But without you, I cannot be. Think what you want. And this way, I cannot go on either with you on earth or with you in heaven. And blessed Jesus interrupted me and told me, calm yourself, calm yourself. I'm not far away from you. I am always with you. That's Joshua 1:5. Even more, I am in your midst. I am in your inmost heart in order to rest. In other words, Louisa is his tabernacle. That's 1 Corinthians 3:16. And you look for me and you bear my privations with patience. You surround me with flowers to cheer me and you make me rest more peacefully. And while he was saying this, it seemed that there were many varieties of flowers around Jesus, which almost concealed him. And then he added, you don't believe that I keep you deprived of me in order to chastise. And yes, it is so. It's the truth. When you least expect it, you will hear of the things that will happen. And while saying this, he showed me in the world wars, revolutions against the church, churches on fire, and this was almost imminent. Okay, so we got 1909 and this World War coming up. And also you've got the revolutions in Russia in 1917. November the 2nd, 1909. Very important message. Never look at the past. Now, if you're in the divine will, you don't look back. Is that okay? So I want to give you Isaiah 43, verses 18 to 19. There's no need to look at the past. There's no need to look at what went before. Behold, I'm doing a new thing. Isaiah 43, verses 18 to 19. Continuing in my usual state, I was thinking about my things of the past. And blessed Jesus, making himself seen for just a little, told me. Now, Louisa will do this because this was the normal thinking in the church at the time. You know, she's being brought into a completely new way of thinking. So she can only be brought gently, step by step, that way. So Jesus said, my daughter, do not look at the past because the past is already in me. And it can be a distraction for you. And the past can make you mistake that little bit of path that is left for you to cover. In other words, in looking back, you're not actually taking the steps forward that you need to do. In fact, your turning to the past makes you slow your pace on the present journey. And so you lose time and you do not advance on your way. On the other hand, by looking only at the present, you will have more courage and you will remain more closely united with me and you will advance more on your path and there will be no danger of your being mistaken. Okay, lots of things you can say there. One of them is a statement that I got from my mother. She actually said it about me. She said, "The galloping horse never looks behind." Something that Jesus said, as distinct from my mother, is sufficient for the day is the evil thereof. Okay. And we have whole books written. I have them inside on my shelves. The practice of the present moment.
Live in the now.
You must live now. God doesn't exist in the past and God doesn't exist in the future. He said, "I am." He is in the present. So when we slip into the past or the future, we've slipped out of that very close union with him. Okay. So November the 4th, 1909, I have a VIP on this one. With his beatitude, God renders all heaven blissful because everything is harmony in him. Having received communion, I was saying to my adorable Jesus, "I'm now tightly united to you," John 14, 20 to 21. And even more, "I'm identified with you." If we are united together, the text says one single thing, which is very difficult English. "I leave my being in you and I take yours." Now watch this. This is something you should actually do. So I leave you my mind and I take yours. We take the divine way of thinking. I leave you my eyes and take the divine way of seeing. I leave you my mouth and take the divine way of speaking. I leave you my heart and take the divine way of loving. I leave you my hands and take the divine way of working. I leave you my steps and take the divine way of life. Terribly important. "Oh, how happy I will be from now on. I will think with your mind. I will look with your eyes. I will speak with your mouth. I will love with your heart. I will work with your hands. I will walk with your feet." That's exactly what Jesus wants for us. "And if something comes to me, I will say, I left my being in Jesus and I took his." My book says his own. You knock out the own. That's not English. "I took his. Go to Jesus and he will answer you for me. Oh, how blissful I feel. Ah, yes, I take from you also your beatitude or your happiness." Now, when you get to the higher volumes, Jesus gives a good bit of attention to the fact that the divine will is happiness. Okay. And that the whole journey into total commitment to the divine will is a journey into total beatitude or happiness. "So I take from you also your happiness," isn't it true, Jesus? "But my life and my good, with your beatitude, you render all heaven blissful. While if I take your beatitude, I make no one blissful." And of course, what's he going to tell her? Wrong. "Why has my being the power of beatifying?" Sorry. Jesus said to me, "My daughter, you too, by taking all of my being along with my beatitude, can make others blissful or happy." We use the word happy rather than blissful. "Why has my being the power of making others happy? Because everything is harmony in me." Now, notice that the harmony is an expression of the happiness. And we're being told all the time in the divine will that he brings us more and more into harmony with ourselves and into harmony with him and into harmony with others. Therefore, he's actually bringing us into beatitude. "One virtue harmonizes, everything is harmony in me. One virtue harmonizes with the other. Justice with mercy, sanctity with beauty, wisdom with strength, immensity with depth and height, so with all the rest." Now, harmony means that a person with this kind of sanctity is not going to be extreme on something, because everything is in harmony. Everything is balanced. And so if you find somebody really extreme on something and claiming to be holy, the extreme tells you there's something wrong. Everything harmonizes. "Everything is harmony in me," he said. "Nothing is discordant. These harmonies make me blissful and I beatify all those who draw near me." So, as you take my being, be careful that all virtues harmonize among themselves. And this harmony will communicate beatitude to whoever draws near you, because in seeing goodness, sweetness, patience, love, and equality in everything in you, they will feel blissful being near you. They're going to see this extraordinary harmony in you. Okay? Like a disharmony that you might have witnessed is that a person can give all their attention to the poor and neglect their family. That's total disharmony, because love begins in the home. You love your neighbour as yourself. Okay. You could find somebody giving away large sums of money and leaving somebody they're actually committed to and must look after, leaving them without it. That's disharmony. I'm just trying to point out that there has got to be wisdom in it. So love that comes to us through the divine will is a love that's wise and patient and good and kind and all the rest of it. But it's not extreme on any point. The extreme thing is wrong. So November the 6th, 1909, the heading I have here is the cross. I was lamenting to Jesus because of his privations and making himself seen for just a little, he told me. My daughter, the cross unites the soul ever more closely to me. Now, we've been told elsewhere and in the hours of the Passion that Jesus gave a section of his cross to each one of us. Remember? We're part of it, whether we like it or not. These privations that you suffer make you fly above yourself. Let me give you in language that's not Louisa language. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Okay? It makes you fly above yourself because not finding the one whom you love in you, life becomes boring to you. All the things that surround you annoy you, and you have nothing to lean on. Now, this is all over the Song of Songs as well, that the bride, when she perceives that the bridegroom is not there, she goes running after him, and she thinks she has lost him forever, and she has to run through the gates of the city at night, and she's got to pass by the guards and be insulted by them, and eventually she finds him. And she throws herself at his feet and clings to him. Now, there's a chapter in John's Gospel that should remind you of. Mary of Magdala on Easter Day. Yeah. Because so if you just put CF, in other words, compare this with John 20, verses 1 to 10. It's the bride going beyond all difficulties to find the bridegroom. Okay. The one on whom alone you used to lean seems to be missing. Notice the word seems, because he's not actually missing. And therefore the soul keeps flying and flying like the great eagle. Okay, the great eagle, Proverbs 30, verses 18 to 19. And Deuteronomy 32, verses 10 to 14. That's Proverbs 30, verses 18 to 19. And Deuteronomy 32, verses 10 to 14. So she keeps flying and flying until she is purged of everything to the point of being consumed. Because you know that when birds take their long flights, some of them at the end of their long flights weigh only half an ounce or an ounce. They've had to let go of everything. And in these consummations, your Jesus will give you the final kiss and you will find yourself in heaven. Aren't you happy? Okay. So November the 9th, he talks about the harmony that's in this union with him. Now, we've looked at the harmony of the virtues. Now we're looking at the harmony of our union with him. As I was in my usual state, I seemed to see our Lord extending his arms within me and playing with his hands a little sonata with an organ while being inside of me. Now, this is not your image, usual image of Jesus, is it? Someone playing on an organ. Okay. Now, I'll let you in on the secret. What he's saying is that there's a song that only you can sing for him. It's the song of your life. Okay. And that song is actually necessary to join all the harmonies of heaven, so that your part of the sonata is in it, okay? So here he is inside of Louisa's heart, and he's playing this little organ. Jesus enjoyed himself, the word amused is not correct, in playing. And I said to him, "Oh, how well you enjoy yourself." And Jesus said, "Yes, I do. You must know that since you have done your things together with me," that's in union with me, "you have loved me with my love, you've adored me with my adorations, you've repaired me with my own reparations," and so on with the rest. Things are immense in you because they're at the divine level, okay? Just as my own. And this union, in its operating, has formed this organ. However, every time you suffer something more, you add another key. And I immediately come to play my little sonata and to see what sound the new key produces. He's like the rest of us, looking for something new. And I enjoy one more enjoyment. Therefore, the more you suffer, the more harmony you add to my organ, and I enjoy myself more. So what he's saying is that everything you go through, the trials, the difficulties, the suffering, everything that you do in the divine will, it all forms part of this extraordinary sonata. It's not an image you would normally have, is it?
No.
But I think it's beautiful. And someday the Lord will play your song for all heaven. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Everyone has a unique tune. Yeah. Isn't it beautiful? November the 16th, 1909. Sin is the only disaster for the soul. After spending bitter days of privation, having received communion, I was lamenting to Blessed Jesus, saying to him, "It really seems you have to leave me completely. But at least tell me, do you want me to go out of this state? Who knows what disorder there is in me that you have moved away?" Notice she keeps her opinion. Do you notice? We find it very difficult to let go an opinion. "Tell me, for I promise you from the heart, I will do more good." Jesus said, "My daughter, do not become alarmed. When I make you lose consciousness," that's going to ecstasy, "remain peaceful. When I don't make you go into ecstasy, remain more peaceful without wasting time. Whatever happens to you, take everything from my hands." Now, that's the book of Sirach, S-I-R, chapter 2, verses 4 to 5. "My son, if you aspire to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for an ordeal and accept everything from the hands of God." And it says, "Whatever happens to you, be patient, because gold is tested in the fire and chosen people tested in the furnace of humiliation." So, "Whatever happens to you, take everything from my hands. Can I not suspend your state for a few days? As for the disorder, I would have told you," because you can't stay in the divine will if there's disorder. "Do you know what puts disorder in the soul? It is only sin." Notice, even the slightest. That's the bit I want you to underline, because we're not Louisa, are we? "Oh, how it deforms her," is the soul, "discolors her and debilitates her." Now, elsewhere in one of the higher volumes, Jesus talks about, it may not be Louisa. No, I think it's Maria Valtorta. The Lord was asked, "How do you see people?" And he said, "I see souls." And he said, the souls of children are snow white, little children, of course, that presumes that have not been abused and destroyed. They're snow white, he said. And he goes on saying, you know, the souls of sinners are black. But the bit I was really interested in was, he says, "The souls of good people who think they're saints," he said, "most of them are grey."
No.
So, and the way he was describing it, what I could see was that you'd be driving along in the car on a dull day, and as far as you're concerned, the windscreen is clean. But let the sun shine, and then all of a sudden you see this smear that was not obvious with the lack of light, but with the increase of light, you can see it. And so that he sees things that we don't see because of our lack of light. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's why I said underline even the slightest, because we can let ourselves off the hook too easily. But the interior states, the privations, they don't do any harm. Therefore, be careful not to offend me even slightly. Now, notice the slightly again. That's the little grey bit, you see. And have no fear of disorder in your soul. So Louisa said, but Lord, there must be something bad in me. She just won't accept where she's at. And she just does not give up, does she? Therefore, you did nothing but come and go. And see, notice she hasn't given up her opinion either in these visits. Sharing of crosses, of nails, of thorns. This is the past. And she realizes that this past is gone. And she's trying to work it out. But he's only going to reveal very slowly where he's taking her, because if the priest would write her off because she couldn't talk about her experience of the Blessed Trinity, can you imagine how he would write her off? And they'd probably kill her off for heresy or whatever if she told him where the Lord was actually taking her. So the Lord can't tell her for her own sake. And he can't tell the priests for their sake either. He's got to reveal it so slowly because it's something completely new. So she says, okay, the sharing of crosses and nails and thorns, all of that is gone. And when nature has become so used to them to the point of considering them natural, imagine getting to that stage with regard to suffering, so much so that suffering is easier for her than not suffering, you withdraw. How is it possible that there is nothing grave in me? And Jesus kindly told me, listen, my daughter, I had to dispose your soul to make you reach this point of delighting in suffering so as to do my work. The work is Philippians 1:6. You remember the work I'm doing in you? Therefore, I had to test you. I had to surprise you. I had to load you with sufferings so that your nature might rise again to new life. In other words, he really spiritualized her. Okay. This work I have completed. That's your Philippians 1:6. Since the participation in my pains has remained in you permanently. Now, this is the suffering that Louisa won't acknowledge. It's only when we go into some of the higher volumes, when she talks in detail about the privations, that she'll talk about the crucifixion she's going through all the time. Okay. And he says, it remains in you permanently, more or less. Now, having completed this work, I am enjoying it. Which, see, he hasn't yet said where he's taking her. All she's aware of in volume 9 is that there's a huge change. And it's the change is going to be greater in volume 10. And then she gets the revelation in volumes 11 and 12. I'm enjoying it, he said. Don't you want me to rest? That's Mark 4:38, Jesus resting in the boat while the storm is on. Mark 4:38. Listen, do not want to think about it. Let your Jesus do it, who loves you very much. In other words, try and give me the freedom if you can. I know when your crafting is necessary, when my crafting is necessary for you. And when I must rest from my work. Okay. So she's going to very gently be opened up to her new role in opening the kingdom of the divine will. So November the 20th, 1909, we have two views of the cross. One from humans who are not looking at it spiritually, and the other is divine. As I was in my usual state, my sweet Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, one who takes the cross according to human views finds it muddy and therefore heavier and more bitter. These are the people who don't have faith and certainly don't have trust in God and don't want the cross to work in them. So think of the people who would rather go on their sleep to Switzerland than suffer a short while before God calls them. On the other hand, one who takes the cross, that's with the divine will, according to divine views, finds it full of light, and sweet. In fact, the human views are without grace, strength, and light. Therefore, she has the boldness to say, why? Now, there's a big, big text somewhere in Louisa's writings about the why of adults. Have we already done it?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so here's the why of the unbelievers coming here as well. So, why did that person do that wrong to me? Why did that this one cause me this displeasure, this calumny? And the soul fills herself with indignation, anger, and revenge. And so the cross becomes muddy, dark, heavy, and bitter. On the other hand, the divine views are full of grace, strength, and light. And therefore, she does not have the boldness to say, Lord, why did you do this to me? On the contrary, she humbles herself, she resigns herself, and the cross becomes light and brings her light and sweetness. So I want to give you Matthew 11:28-30 for that. My burden is light, do you remember? So Matthew 11:28-30. So November 25th, 1909. Both in Jesus and in souls, the first crafting is done by love. Now, the reference here is to the hours of the Passion and talking about Jesus's agony, where he says that the first agony was love, and then the second one was the agony given to him by sin, and then the third one, the agony given to him by the Jews. He's going to refer to that here. Finding myself in my usual state, I was thinking about the agony of Jesus in the garden. And blessed Jesus, making himself seen for just a little, told me, my daughter, men did nothing but work the skin of my humanity. Now, if you're into Latin, put ad extra in your margin on the outside. OK, on the outside, ad extra, E-X-T-R-A. While the eternal love worked all in my interior, ad intra, I-N-T-R-A. So love worked the interior, and the Jews or the Romans did the outside. So in my agony, the eternal love, the immense love, the incalculable love, the hidden love, not men, opened large wounds in me, pierced me with flaming nails, crowned me with burning thorns, made me drink boiling gall. And my humanity, unable to contain so many different martyrdoms at the same time, poured out large streams of blood. Now, there is the only explanation of the sweating of blood that comes from himself. And therefore, we put aside everybody else's opinion. I know lots of people, including priests, who think he sweated blood because he was afraid. He was afraid to die of crucifixion. Which means that they don't know who he is. My humanity writhed and reached the point of saying, Father, if it be possible, let this chalice pass from me. That's Luke 22:42. Luke 22:42. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Which it did not say in the rest of the Passion. It was only said in the agony. Everything I suffered during the course of the Passion, I suffered all together in the agony. He suffered the whole thing. That's why in Mark's Gospel, at the end of the agony, he says, it's all over. It's all over. But I suffered it together in the agony, but in a more intense, more painful, more intimate way, intimate meaning in every part of his innermost being, body, soul and spirit. Because love penetrated deep into the marrow of my bones and into the most intimate fibres of my heart, which creatures could never reach. But love reaches everything. There is nothing that can resist love. So my first executioner was love. Now don't forget, God is love. 1 John 4:7. God is love. This is why, in the course of my Passion, there was not even a reproachful glance in me towards those who acted as my executioners. Now, Louisa is very clear about that in all her commentary throughout the hours of the Passion. because I had a more cruel, more active executioner inside of me, which was love. So love demanded that he pay for every sin of every person of all time. The people killing him from the outside could not possibly have even have understood that, let alone inflicted enough pain. And there the external executioners could not reach, the ad extra ones, or a little part of me was spared. Love would continue its work and spare me nothing. Okay, so love paid for our redemption. Now, this is the good news coming up. This happens in all souls. The first work is done by love. And once love has worked her and filled her with itself, what appears on the outside is nothing but the outpouring and crafting that love has performed on the inside. The whole miracle of the spiritual life is completely hidden and completely interior. And most of the time, the Lord doesn't even tell us what he's doing, in case we would block it or stop it in some way. So it's entirely a work of love. Okay. So December the 22nd, 1909. And it's the reason for the state of abandonment in holy souls before their death. Notice before their death. So euthanasia is an absolutely criminal thing to do to anybody, because it stops them from having the purification before death. St. John of the Cross says that God allows a lot of people to have a painful illness before they die. And the painful illness does the purification so that their purgatory is minimized on the other side. Nowadays, we don't allow them to suffer. And we therefore don't do anything to prevent the purgatory, do we? And then we don't even believe in purgatory. We say they're canonized just because they died. So having received communion, Louisa said, I was lamenting to Blessed Jesus because of his privations. For if he comes, it's almost always like a flash, or he remains all silent. Now, he's always silent when he's chastising. And he told me, my daughter, in almost all souls, so that includes you and me, to whom I have communicated myself in an extraordinary way. Well, that mightn't include you and me, because I think the extraordinary way is the way of the victim souls. I have allowed these states of abandonment at the end of their lives. Now, do you remember Mother Teresa of Calcutta? She had most wonderful experiences of God, and he told her to set up this new order of religious, which has now spread all over the world. And from the time she set it up, all her experiences just disappeared and she was in darkness. That's the state of abandonment. This not only because of certain other purposes of mine, but also in order to be honoured and glorified in all of my conduct. In fact, many say, of course these souls were to reach such a high point of sanctity, and they loved him very much. With so many favours and so many graces and charisms, they'd have to be really ungrateful not to reach that level. If we had received them, we too would have reached it more than them. Oh, wow. So in order to justify my conduct, Jesus said, I will manifest to them the abandonments, the privations in which I put these souls, which is a living purgatory for them, and also their faithfulness and their heroism of their virtues, and how it is easier to suffer poverty when one doesn't know riches than to be born rich, getting used to living as a rich person and then lose the riches and live like a poor one. That is the problem with Louisa and the privations. She has been so privileged. She has been so graced that living without it is quite impossible. More so, since the supernatural riches are not like the material ones which serve the body and at most diffuse on the outside, the supernatural riches penetrate deep into one's marrow. Now, we know this from everything we've read in Louisa. Into the most intimate fibres, into the noblest part of the intelligence, it is enough to say that it is more than martyrdom, in other words, to be deprived of him. Okay. I myself am moved to pity so much that my heart almost breaks with tenderness. And I'm forced to feel it break so very often that I cannot resist. Also, to give them the strength to fulfill their consummation. That is the final stage of their sacrifice. All angels and saints keep their gazes fixed on these souls, and they watch over them for me so that they may not succumb, knowing the crude martyrdom that they suffer. My daughter, courage, you are right, but know that everything is love in me. Okay, that's Psalm 145, verse 17. God only ever acts out of love. There's a little statement that people make as well, and that is, you give all to find all. If you want all, you have to give all. Okay. So as Jesus was saying this, he seemed to be moving further away, Louisa said. I felt my very nature being consumed and melted into nothingness. So here we have the nothingness and the allness in this paragraph. Okay. Those seeds of strength, light, knowledge that I seem to feel, everything turned into nothing. I felt I was dying, yet I live. In the meantime, he came back, and taking me in his arms, he seemed to sustain this nothingness of mine, telling me, do you see, my daughter, how, as the little seed of your strength, the little lamp of your light, and notice little all the time, meaning tiny, the little knowledge of me that you have and all the other little qualities dissolve. My strength, my light, my wisdom, my beauty and all my other qualities take over and fill this nothingness of yours. That's why he wants us to go into our nothingness, because he wants to fill it with everything that's his. And Louisa said to him, listen, Jesus, if you continue in this way, you will lose taste for keeping me on earth. And she repeated this various times, and Jesus, not wanting to listen to her words, said, listen, my daughter, I will never lose taste for you. If I keep you on the earth, I will have my taste on earth. If I take you to heaven, I will have my taste in heaven. Do you know who will lose taste? It's your confessor. That's very interesting, isn't it? Okay, so we'll do another one, which is February the 24th, 1910. Louise is not able to manifest her interior to the confessor. This morning at communion, I was lamenting to Jesus, for I am no longer able to manifest my state to the one I'm supposed to. Yes, many times I feel filled with the Lord. I seem to touch him everywhere. And even in touching myself, I touch Jesus. Now, look at that. Look at what a high level of presence that is. And yet I can't say a word. I would but dissolve myself in Jesus in the depths of the most strict silence. Now, sometimes you get the impression that people in the divine will are supposed to be saying prayers all the time. That's not actually true. And make sure there's a balance. We have to have this contemplation in which you just plunge yourself into the depths of the heart of Jesus and you just stay there. Look at this, in the depths of the most strict silence. Okay, that's the deepest union of all, that strict silence. Now that silence means silence of my mind, of my thoughts, of my heart, of my feelings, of everything. Everything is silent in me. It's not just silence outside. And if I'm forced or spurred on to speak, oh God, what an effort I have to make. I feel like a child who feels so very sleepy and they want to wake her up by force and she throws a tantrum. So I said to Jesus, you have deprived me of everything, of your sufferings, of your favours, of your harmonious, sweet and gentle voice. I no longer recognise myself from the way I have become. And if you let me understand anything, it's so deep inside that it does not find a way to come out. Now, in the higher volumes, the Lord will give her a way to be able to express it. Tell me, my life, how should I behave? And Jesus said, "My daughter, if you have me, you have everything. And this must be enough for you. If you feel filled with me, it's a sign that I keep you in the house of my divinity." Look at this. Now, in the early volumes, you're in the house of the humanity. Now she's gone up into the house of the divinity, which means she's living constantly in the divine will. And this business of she's in this very deep silence, and whatever happens is at such a deep level that it's nearly impossible to find words to say it. She is beginning to touch the fact that she's living at this level of the divine will. If a rich person, Jesus said, admits a poor one into his house, it's a sign that he will give to the poor one everything he needs. That's God giving Louisa everything she needs. Even if he doesn't always speak to him or caress him. Otherwise, it would be a dishonor for the rich one. Am I not more than the rich one? Therefore, calm yourself and try to manifest what you can to obedience. As for the rest, leave everything to my care. Because gradually, when she becomes more familiar with being on this divine level all the time, it'll be okay. Do you want me to do another one, or do you want me to stop?
Stop.
A lot to take in.
Okay, do you want me to stop?